Welcome to the podcast from Stazza Stable, The Stable Master Speaks. My name's John Starrett, aka The Stable Master. And as usual, this podcast is not scripted. All mistakes stay in for your amusement and my horror. There's no editing. And we don't do the patron sponsorship and asking for money malarkey. In fact, we give away the best prizes of any podcast on the planet. We've already given away 2 2-week trips to the Caribbean, 2 2-week trips to Mauritius, and 4 pairs of cheetah shoes. Stay tuned for the competition this week, which is 2 2-week trips to the tropical island of Koh Samui in Thailand. The question will be towards the end of the podcast. You will have to listen closely to get the answer right. This one's going to be a little bit tougher than normal. And just on the podcast, just a little bit of quick feedback from last week. It was fantastic. I've never had so much feedback. Everybody really enjoyed it. So that was good. Everybody got it, the joke that was going on there. And just to add a little bit of context to that, for anybody that didn't quite get it, there was a clue in the podcast halfway through about New Zealand and a mail runner in Dopen. So that sort of fed into the trolling. And just to talk about trolling, I like a good bit of trolling myself, as many of you know. But really, with this, I've got sort of 3 ways that I look at it. Either ignore it, which is a mature way, which I don't because I'm puerile. I'm like a teenager. Or to get engaged with it and have a bit of fun, which I normally do because I like a bit of trolling. Or you can actually quash it. And I say quash, not squash. Quash is a correct word there. And I think that's what we did last week. We didn't knock it out of the park. We knocked it onto the moon. I think Kaz is up on the moon waiting to get down to Boston. But we'll see. Good luck in Boston, Kaz. Hope it all goes well. So let's dive into the meat of the podcast because I don't want to ramble too much. As I've alluded to in previous podcasts, we're going to be looking at people who are on their journey for sub 3 hours or down to sub 2:30. We're going to be doing case studies of people who have done it already and looking at their life and the training that they did. And we're going to be, which is an easy thing to do with hindsight and look back and say, oh, so-and-so did this and so did that. But we're putting ourselves out there, as we always do, and we're saying that's the dog scratching on the window. What we're going to do is say these people are going to do this and we're going to follow their journeys. And I think you'll find it interesting, you know, to look at the training. And what you'll find is that the training that they do will give a lot more context to the first season of podcast where I was talking about the different sort of principles of training. So, and we've got a special guest with us today, somebody that I've known for quite a while now. Is Mark O'Mahony or Mark O'Mahony or Mark O'Mahony, excuse the pronunciation. And Mark, I've known him for a good few years now. He's a coach. He's got a colourful background, and I'm just going to give you a quick overview of his background, and then we'll get stuck into the meat of things with Mark and his training and his life. So if I've got this correctly, and my researchers say that I have, my researchers being me, is that Mark is a twin, and as a child, he's regarded as the runt of the family. I say runt of the family. And his lucky brother got all the love from the parents. Mark was kind of a little bit isolated, a little bit lonely growing up. And then he's moved into his teen years. Unfortunately, the puppy fat got hold of him and he bloated, got pimples and spots, got bullied and was really quite a lonely child. Nowhere to turn. He turned to movies like many kids do or music. But Mark, it was the Karate Kid. Inspired by Daniel San and slightly in love with Daniel San, he started on a journey of unsecure about his sexuality. And as he progressed through his later teen years and started watching like boxing and kickboxing and Muay Thai, he loved the whole thing, the whole idea about like being a man and being in the ring with guys with their tops off. But more importantly, he reminds me of D.H. Lawrence, the great English novelist and poet from Nottingham, in that D.H. Lawrence often said that he'd love to be out there being a roughy-tufty man, but preferred being in the kitchen, mopping the floors and doing the dishes. Mark reminds me a little bit of that, at least in his formative years. But we'll have a little look and see how things progress for Mark. He left school, lost, but kind of found his way a little bit because watching all of the videos, the men with their tops off and sweating and fighting in the ring and things like that, he got drawn to the gym and started doing a little bit of kickboxing, shadow boxing, in fact, first of all, and then kickboxing and Muay Thai. He went off to Thailand, to Koh Samui with his twin brother, and they did some training camps out there, had a few fights. And as I mentioned in the previous podcast, he shattered his tibia, and that was, he thought it was the end of his Muay Thai and kickboxing years, but he came back to Ireland, gathered himself and got back out there again, but realised he just didn't have the talent for it. or the discipline or the ability. He realised he was going to spend his life as somebody who's clasping at things and could never achieve, until he saw an advert for a 100-mile race and decided to enter it off hardly any training, completed in about 3 days, and got injured, come back, and then reached out to me for training. And lo and behold, I don't know how many weeks it was, a few weeks, he won a 12-hour race and then started training for the Belfast 24-hour race, where he wanted to break the Irish record. Great shape, fantastic shape, in fairness to him, followed everything to a T. But then on the morning of the race, he tested positive for COVID, and that was the end of that. And then his wiggly-waggly tailbone, which is we're going to talk about, gave him a problem, and he was out for a year. We're going to go into how he resolved that. And just on his wiggly-waggly tailbone, I was asking him about it, and he was telling me that the reason this happened was when he was out in Thailand, he was still not 100% secure in his sexuality, and he wasn't sure if he was a man, a woman, or a ladyboy. So he practiced walking like ladyboys, and that's what's given him his kind of like a loose tailbone. But since then, now he's found himself, he's met a woman, he's settled down, the lovely Claire, they've got a baby, Penny, things are moving forward, he's over his injury. He came out to Kenya this year, and lo and behold, we've transformed him. He's found himself, he knows where he's going. He's got a PB of 3:22 for the marathon, and he's looking to run 2:29 in Valencia. So in the space of a year, we're going to take that time off from 3:22 to 2:29. So let me introduce the legend in his own lunchtime. And talking of lunch, actually, just to set the scene here, we've just been out for lunch and we both ordered the same thing. We had spring rolls, duck spring rolls. We had a curry. Where we differed is Mark went for a dessert. I didn't. I went outside and just sort of, I couldn't look at the dessert. It was too big. He had a big chocolate or Toblerone cheesecake or something like that. But he's earned the right to have that. He's comfortable with his eating condition now. That's something else that we might go into. And then come back. And I just said to him, look, we're not going to script this. We're just going to dive in and bang it out there. So welcome to the podcast, Mark O'Mahony.
Thanks very much for that intro, John. Definitely colourful.
So, but I mean, in fairness, obviously, all jokes aside, the main sort of thrust or line of that intro is correct. So you're a twin, yeah. And you got into, I mean, when did you first get into the kickboxing in Muay Thai? Is it Muay or Mo?
Muay Thai, but some people pronounce it Muay Thai. Thai boxing is easier.
Thai boxing, that's what I'm going to use from henceforth. Just a quick question on Thai boxing. Do you think that people go into Thai boxing and MMA and all that sort of stuff because they can't make it as boxers?
No. No, I think it comes down to personal preference. I think Thai boxing's growing a lot in the last few years in Ireland. I think Conor McGregor, obviously MMA, is pushing that as well with regards to mixed martial arts. But no, it's definitely growing all the time. I think Martin Horgan as well, one of the biggest Thai boxing promoters in the country, is you know, he's doing shows for the last 20 years. Martin just fought there on the weekend as well. Martin's about 40 odd now at this stage. Won his fight, third round TKO, I think, and still going strong, still producing a lot of talent in this country. So I don't know about the boxing scene too much. I'd be more interested in the mixed martial arts side of things.
Okay, but one of the things that I've looked at, and this sort of I've mentioned to Ali the Chin Smith, who does the Stable News for us, and he was the world champion in kickboxing and Muay Thai.
Muay Thai.
And I said to him, like, you know, to me, the Muay Thai guys are too square on, and it'd be easy to take, you know, like a left jab, right hook, whatever, and they're just going to go down. The punches are like kids in the playground or women, you know, are drunk outside of a pub. There's no like power in the punching because they're square on. But I suppose they do kick the shins and things, as you found out when your shin got shattered. And you were telling me earlier that, you know, that was one of your specialities, not getting shattered shins, but like swiping people with the feet. So I can see why you might need to be square on. But what was it that inspired you to get into Muay Thai? I mean, I know your favourite movie of all time is A Karate Kid, but what was it?
Yeah, so when we were teenagers, I suppose about 18, 19, big into drinking at the time. And me and my brother, my buddies, we used to obviously go out, and I suppose we were prone to getting into fights at the time. And a couple of local lads that we were fighting with were training Muay Thai at the time. And I guess we didn't know what we were doing, essentially, in defending ourselves. So we said, look, we better yeah, arm ourselves up and, oh geez, that's the wrong word to say. We better learn to defend ourselves anyway. And we obviously didn't want to go to the same gym that the lads we were fighting with, so we went to a different gym down the road. And we never had the intention of fighting, but one of the trainers there, after I'd say 2 or 3 months training there, we went to a show where he was fighting, and there was about 10 lads from the one gym fighting there. And we said, Jesus, if we want to get into fighting, this is the gym we need to go to. So went to that gym then, and 3 months later had our first fight. And then 2 months after that, first trip to Thailand, went out to Thailand and learning from the best there, training with some of the best, you know, train twice a day, 6 hours a day, 6 days a week. And it just kind of went on from there, really.
Yeah, in terms of when you went out to Thailand, I mean, did you go out with a rucksack with a pair of dirty wife fronts, or were you prepared for it? And what was it like out there in terms of the changing cultures? A big difference between being a mammy's boy, or not a mammy's boy, but wanting to be a mammy's boy, and going out to Thailand, and, you know, the culture, the food, you're not having bacon and cabbage, you know. So what was that like?
Yeah, we were lucky. Like, the first gym we went to was Kiet Phuong Thip Gym, so it was just outside Bangkok. So, I mean, it wasn't, like, say, many distractions that you'd have a lot of times if you go to a gym in Bangkok. A lot of people will go on a Saturday night and they lose themselves to Bangkok because there's a lot of distractions and things. Whereas we were lucky the first time we went out there, we were out basically in the countryside. Obviously, the weather was a big factor for us, you know, like training in the heat. It was the first time we came across using electrolytes, you know, just to replace the sweat. And then you're learning about your body as well, like training, you know, 6 hours a day, two sessions a day, 3 hours a session, and, you know, learning about recovery and just fueling the body as well, and just getting the calories back in. And yeah, it was we kept it a competition, you know. So there was me and my brother, two other Irish lads, Sean Clancy, who was probably one of the biggest names to come out of Ireland in terms of Thai boxing, fought in one championship, the biggest organization in the world. Aaron O'Callaghan, another big name in Irish Thai boxing as well. So, you know, we went out with good lads, you know, they were good people to be around, they were there to train. You know, obviously we went out the odd time, but very little distractions, because there was very little to actually go and do. It was just about the training and, just to go up another level.
Yeah, and you mentioned to me previously about one time that you went out and you were walking down the street and these two women grabbed hold of you and dragged you into a bar, and you said you couldn't fend them off, only to find out later that they were ladyboys. Is this where your affinity or thing with ladyboys started?
Yeah, actually, I remember. Yeah, so we said we better go to Koh San Road, because when you go to Thailand or you go to Bangkok, that's essentially the road you go on if you're going to go out. It's where all the tourists go. So one night we did go to Koh San Road. I can't remember which part now or whatever, but we were just walking down, and these two ladyboys were standing outside a bar anyway, and, you know, they just grabbed hold of me, like, to bring me into the bar. And, like, you think, oh, they're like women, like, I should be okay with this, but I really struggled. I really struggled to fend them off, and I was genuinely a little bit scared, like, how strong they were. And I was asking the lads, you know, to give me a hand. They were just laughing at me, and I don't know, eventually I got away. But it was a realization, this is a different world.
Were they like the Juba brothers, like 6'6", solid?
Oh, yeah.
Big yeah. Lady boys. Okay, yeah. Excellent stuff. So, but just then also just sort of diving in a little bit deeper there, what was it like from the food point of view? You know, instead of having Weetabix for breakfast or porridge, what would you have? What would the daily sort of nutrition be like? What would you eat?
Yeah, food was incredible. We were, again, very, very lucky. Rob Cox, who was English, he owned the gym with his wife, and his wife and all the cooking. Fantastic cook, brilliant lady. Again, she'd ask us, you know, if we didn't like something, you know, that she'd make something else. If any of us were vegetarian, she'd make that. And just very, very nice people. So again, I think we would know before dinner what's going to be there. But like, it was just your typical, I suppose, green vegetables, rice, and then, you know, just whatever meat was there, chicken or whatever. But again, yeah, I suppose what we wouldn't be used to is, you know, different spices and things like that. But as I said, yeah, just very, very nice lady, and she looked after us well.
Yeah, and you mentioned there about the spices and thing and the spice of life of Thailand and all of that. Did you start to get more and more into Thai food, or did you stick with kind of keeping it kind of simple? We've just had a curry there, nice spicy curry. I think a little bit of aniseed in the sauce or something like that, which I mentioned at the time. Would you be somebody who's into spicy stuff?
I'm okay with spice. I suppose it definitely, what age was I? I was 19 at the time going out here. We grew up on chicken and vegetables, really. My sister was quite fussy growing up. So most of the time in the house, it was just chicken, potatoes, veg. So it definitely opened up our world in terms of food, and I suppose it just kind of went on from there. I mean, in our house, we never had fish growing up, and now we eat fish all the time. So yeah, it definitely opened up our eyes to new food, new culture.
Yeah, and then we've been in sort of Thailand for the first time and going into the Thai boxing. Talk us through, I mean, like what you said there, that you, 2 sessions a day, 6 hours a day. What would a typical day look like, you know, in terms of what would you do training-wise? Because I'm thinking back to my boxing days and, you know, we'd go into the gym and might go for a run in the morning and then in the evening go down the club. You know, you do like some skipping, some shadow, a little bit on the bags, some circuits and then some light sparring, depending where you are in terms of where on the fight scene. But what was it like with the Thai boxing? Was it similar or...?
Yeah, so first thing in the morning, you do about a 10K run and then you come back, it'd be about... typically 20 minutes, half an hour of skipping. You would do maybe some bag work then or also some shadow boxing while at the same time some lads were on the pads.
Yeah.
So you'd kind of just wait for your turn on the pads. Then you typically do around 5 rounds in the pads and then you might go back to the bag until everyone's done their rounds of pads. And then you could finish up with some clinching work or else again some more bag work with knees or something, or else you'd be kicking on the bag for a while. And that's your session number one. Session number two would be a lighter run because you're kind of in the afternoon time now, so it's a lot hotter in the day. So you typically maybe just about 5 or 6K in the afternoon. Come back, same thing again, skipping again for about half an hour. Again, sometimes while you're skipping, someone will be on pads. You wait for your turn on pads and you might finish up the day with some light sparring, maybe some light kinching, but a lot more technical than we'd be used to at home. What you would notice from being out here in Thailand than from being at home is they definitely go a lot easier on each other. You know, they're being careful not to go too hard. Over in this side of the world, we tend to go a lot harder, like in sparring, whereas over there it's sabai, which is just, you know, easy, just a bit more technical.
Yeah, and did they do much work on the technical side of things, you know, technique or on the pads and stuff?
On the pads, they would, you know, small corrections here and there was always the thing. You know, they're not going to try and change too much of your style. It's just little corrections here and there. But I mean, really, it's trying to figure it out yourself. You know, when you're in a clinch with someone, you're sparring with someone, you're trying to problem solve yourself, because that's where you learn as a fighter. It's about problem solving. Same thing in a ring, you need to problem solve.
Yeah. So would you say then this is kind of where the running part comes in, and the fitness is that, because it's one thing problem solving while you're fresh. It's like Tyson says, everyone's got a plan until they get smacked in the chops. You know, do you think that's important in the Thai boxing world as well? Is that fitness is like the key that underpins everything else? Or would say like a technical fighter or a big banger, would they beat somebody who was like fit and average? I mean, where's the win come from in Thai boxing? Is it a technical thing, power, or is it a mixture of everything?
I think it's a mixture, but also, I mean, you just have to look at the fighters. Like, going look at myself and my brother was a much more of a technical fighter than I was. I was probably a little bit grittier. I kind of get the head smacked off me a bit more than he did. You know, he was more clever at dodging shots than I was. But you know that we were both good fighters at the end of the day. You know, and then people would always ask who would win in a fight. It's hard to say.
Yeah, I remember back in my boxing days. One of the few times I've ever been taught a lesson in my life that I listened to or learned from. And I was fighting. I was in the Air Force at the time, and I was fighting a guy. I think I was fighting at 9'7" lightweight. And boxing a guy from the US Air Force. And my coach didn't tell me beforehand, but he was a Golden Gloves champion of Philadelphia. And I remember like trying to psych the guy out and having a bit of bants with him, as you can imagine the way I was. But this guy was a good bit taller than me and more muscular. And I remember coming in, my coach had like done all the work on him, and because he was taller. So we were working on when he comes out and he throws his first left jab. I'd just come down, left jab to the stomach, underneath the left arm, and bang on the chin. And it worked to a treat. I just couldn't have gone any better. Hardest ever hit anybody in my life. He just stepped back, give me a nod, and then give me the boxing lesson in my life. But what was beautiful about this lesson was the guy knew that I was nowhere near in his class, and he could have just dropped me at any time. And instead of dropping me, he just boxed the head off me, pulling punches instead of putting the full power into them. And I remember going to him afterwards and talking to him and saying, thanks, you know, and all of that. And he says, no. He says, I think you want to get out of this game. And he was right. That was my last ever fight. So I stopped boxing after that. So now I understand where you're coming from there. And what about in the evenings? What was it like there, you know, at nighttime? Were you know, obviously you wouldn't have had Netflix and things like that. So what would you do in the evenings? Play cards?
Jeez, that's a good one, actually. What was that, 19? That was a while back. Again, I'm kind of keep going back to my first trip there. There was very little to do. We'd all kind of gather around in, say, where you would eat, and there was just a TV in there, and you might just watch some shows, or else you'd get, again, just kind of scroll through your phone or something on the Facebook or something like that. You might ring home, but really in the evenings, I mean, we didn't go out anywhere. I think there was that one time in Koh San Road, but other than that, during the day, it was just kind of trying to get to bed as early as you could for to get up to go train the next day.
And what time would you get up in the mornings and start training?
First one, 6 a.m.
So that was everybody out, 6 a.m.
Yeah,
yeah. Was that as a group or individual?
As a group, yeah.
Excellent, good. Yeah. And then, did you fight at all when you were out there on your first trip?
First trip, no, because I had a fight, I think it was 3 or 4 weeks later, because I was out there in January and I had a fight at the end of February. So I was training for that.
And how did that go?
Lost. I lost, but I think that was actually my second ever fight, but I lost the fight, but at the same time, my brother actually lost his fight as well. But the two people knew we could take a beating after that. Like, I lost the first two rounds. I got the head hit off me, but, you know, I kept going, won the third round, and I got a lot of respect from that fight, I feel, because people knew I could take a beating.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that was your biggest strength in the fight game, is that you could, like, take a beating? Or do you reckon?
Well, I think that's one part of, I suppose, Marin Horgan's philosophy is, like, he definitely, like, breeds a lot of tough fighters. And, you know, I think with Thai boxing and being out in Thailand as well, they will try and break your spirit, especially if you have a fight coming up. I remember the second time I was out there and I had a fight coming up in Lumpini, and they will try and break your spirit as much as they can in the gym, like, break you down and wear you down and see will you just give up. Because if a fighter can sustain that kind of beating in training and not give up, well, then they know that he'll be fine on his own when he's in the ring. So yeah, I've seen grown men cry in the ring and in training because of the beatings they're taking from other people at the gym. And again, it's just to try and see, you know, can we improve your will, or is it easily broken? So that was one thing. Like, I would try and hold it together. I remember, like there was one. I was sparring with Claudio, who's WBC champion in his weight, and I was on my own at the time, actually, because it's the second time I was out there, and I was taking knees off him in the head. He kept, like, in the clinch, kept forcing my head down and, like, kneeing me into the head, and I just took a serious beating off him, and he kept giving out to me because he kept saying, like, you know, like, keep your head up, and I was like, you're fucking a lot stronger than I am, and I went back to my room like crying, because I was like, what the hell am I doing here? But, like, you know, I held it together there and then, didn't give up. And, you know, again, it's just kind of just keep it together and just don't give up, basically.
So it was, back then, it was kind of like old school, same way in the boxing as well, you know, losing weight and doing loads of training, not too much science or smartness behind the training. A little bit, I suppose, if we cross-reference that to running, it's a little bit like beginner runners or people who suffer from the addiction of running. And they run too fast on their easy runs, and they're not too smart with it all. Would that be a fair analogy?
Yeah, I think, and it's definitely a mistake I made when I first started running as well. Is you think it's just this go hard or go home mentality, and it will get you, like, you will progress to some degree, but eventually the body will break down and you will get injured. Yeah.
Okay. So let's peel that back then. So you came back from Thailand after your first visit, and you had your fight, which you lost, but you took a good beating and proved to the world that you'd grown from the young boy into a man. But then I'm just thinking now, like, how did you finance the trip out to Thailand, and what did you do? Did you come back from work wise or, I mean, win the lottery? What happened?
Yeah, so when I first left school, what age? I was 19 when I first left school, and my dad was doing this job. He was money lending at the time, and when you do this job, it was all legit, it was for a company. And when you do it, it's, you basically take it on as a self-employed role, though. Like, you'd organise your own holiday. So he had to go on holiday, he wanted someone to fill in, and you need someone you can trust when you're doing this job, because you're handling a lot of money. So he asked me to do it, but I fill in when I was on holidays. I did, and he was like, look, would you want to maybe do this with me a little bit? So we did it, like, say, on, you know, we kind of shared the role for a few months, and then he was like, I'm getting out of this, I'm sick of it. So, yeah, when I was about 20, I just started doing that on my own. And that's essentially how I financed the trip. Again, when I went out the first time, he obviously filled in for me. Like, it was a 52 week, you know, a year job. There was no holidays, no time off, and he filled in when I was while I was out in that time.
So when you started doing that job, you mentioned to me before, I might get this wrong, so you know, correct me if I am, but the type of people that were being lent the money to were people who had like addiction problems and people on the lower end of the social spectrum, if that's the right way to phrase it, if it isn't tough. But did you ever have any run-ins with anybody, like, you know, anybody try it on with you to like, say, no, I'm not paying, and we'll pay back and give you a dig?
Yeah, again, like, you know, that job, I suppose, it woke me up to what to, it made me grow up faster, I should say, mm-hmm. that job. I mean, people are talking to you face-to-face, and you kind of have to read between the lines.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times they won't tell you, I'm not paying, but they'll make up some excuse, and you just, even though I'm 19, I'm kind of a bit young, you kind of have to know that this person's lying to me. But there's not a lot I can do. Again, it's, you know, I'm not going to rough anyone up. Again, it's for a company. It's money at the end of the day. It's not worth that kind of stuff. But you would meet the salt of your people. You would meet the most loveliest people ever. I met financial advisors I was loaning money to.
Wow.
You know, people that worked in banks. And then you meet people that are on the dole. You met people with gambling addictions, drug addictions, people who are in jail now for various different reasons. And I got myself into a few rough situations. But again, nearly everyone that I was calling to knew that I was fighting. So even though I was getting myself into some sticky situations, I was lucky that nothing bad ever really happened.
Yeah, in fairness, that's one of the, and this is the only compliment you're getting, one of the things that I've noticed about you is that you've got the fighter's eye for things, that you're really quick at assessing things, and you see the nuance and the subtleties of what's going on around you. You're aware of the space that you exist in. It's like today when that lady touched your hand and you were going to knock her out and I had to stop you. We were out at the restaurant, a little old lady came past and she put her hand on the chair where Mark was sitting and touched his hand, and he was up like a shot thinking somebody was after him. So, but you know, those things are important as a fighter because you've got to see through the BS and everything. So you come back and you were doing that, and then you went back out. How long were you back out to Thailand for the second time, and whereabouts?
So the second time then, we booked a three-month trip. Well, I booked a three-month trip. My brother came out with me for the first 4 weeks. And we stayed at a gym. Jeez, I can't remember the name of it now, actually. But we didn't stay there long. We moved to another gym. We didn't like the first one. We moved to Eminent Air Gym. And fantastic people. I knew one of the lads there came and picking at the time, was living there. And we were training there. And a tough gym, like, it was pure, again, old school gym. There was no even rubber floor mats on the ground. It was just, you were just training on concrete. Mm. So it's just pure old school. And again, some great people there. And I was 6 weeks there and had a fight then in Lumpini Stadium, which was the old Lumpini Stadium at the time. It's knocked down since. Not too many foreigners would have fought there. But again, I was very lucky because the owner of the gym was a promoter there. So he had connections. So he got me into fighting Lumpini Stadium. And I don't know if anyone ever here fought in Lumpini Stadium, but like, when you fight in Lumpini Stadium, you weigh in the morning of it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you weigh in, you have to weigh in naked.
Okay,
and
yeah.
And they don't leave you, put a towel around you.
Just one sec, sorry to cut across. That's closed now, has it?
Well, they've knocked it down, they've built a new one.
I was going to give it a visit. Go ahead and carry on. So you're, yes, you're naked,
you
getting
wet. You weigh in, and you weigh in, and they tell you, like, take your shorts off, and then you're covering yourself off, and they move your hands and everything to make sure you can't cover yourself.
Are you sure
off.
This is knocked down? Go on.
So yeah, so wait in the morning of it, and then you fight then the evening time. So I fought a fellow from New Zealand, actually, and I was doing quite well at the time. And I remember, right, the fourth round, right, his I was waiting in the centre ring to start. His coach was kind of giving out, you know, saying he really had to, you know, step things up for this round. And I hit him with a shot, kicked him into the leg, and I could see I really hurt him. He kind of started to limp. So I went to finish him off, basically. I wound up the shot, and he blocked it with his knee. I knew straight away something was seriously wrong. Tried to put some weight on my leg, and I could just feel the bones crunching up against each other. So I couldn't put any weight in the leg, kind of hobbled over to the ropes, had one leg in the air, like leaning on top of the ropes, and he's just elbowing me on top of the head. I couldn't really defend myself, so the referee stopped the fight, and I kind of hobbled over, and they wheeled me in a wheelchair out. And my corner, Santi, came over, and he was like, okay, we go home. And I'm like, I'm here with like a flimsy shim that's dangling in my hand, and I'm like, we need to go to the hospital. He's like, no, you're okay. And I'm like, I'm not okay. And he's like, no, you're okay. And I was like, we need to go to the hospital. So a little bit back and forth, and eventually we went to the hospital, and they told the lads back at the gym that I was fine. And even my brother was ringing them, and he was asking, they all told my brother I was fine, you know, that my leg wasn't broken. Mm-hmm. And then we got the x-ray back, and it was just clean break through the tibia. And they were like, oh, it really is broken.
So on a scale of 10, on a scale of 1 to 10, how was that a 10?
To be honest with you, breaking it there and then wasn't too bad. Like, even feeling the bones crunching up against each other was sore. But it was actually the drive there was nearly worse. It was the vibration in the car. Yeah. Because I was lying down in the back seat was torture. And actually, I remember as well when I was in the cast, the next few, say, nights and the next few weeks, was sometimes I twitch in my sleep. And what would happen is I would twitch in my sleep and I'd wake up screaming because I'm after twitching my leg. And there was a French fella in the bed next to me, and he didn't understand English, or he couldn't speak English. So I'd wake up screaming, and he'd text me. He'd have to do it on Google Translator, like, are you okay? And I'd have to be like, yeah, I'm fine. So it was more the rehab was the sore part.
To me, I mean, and big shout out to Matthew Jeffrey here. It sounds a little bit like Matthew, whom we're going to talk about on future podcasts. Like Matthew's, he came to me, he was a 140... half marathon runner. I think within 6 months he was running 122 123, going really, really well. And then he sent me a message saying that he was feeling really tired and he had a cyst on his neck. So I said, go to the doctors. Within a week the doctor says, no, it's just a cyst. A week later it was cancer, and he ended up sort of going through all the treatment for that. And he was really unfortunate because I think he'd just got a job working for the police in the UK almost within the week of this being diagnosed. And God, he used to phone me all the time crying about his cancer. And I said, have I told you about my elbow when I fell off the bike? And I got the 8 pins in my elbow. So this is like an ongoing thing between me and Matthew. Poor lad, like, he got back, he did all the usual stuff post-cancer, and he recovered and did all the raising money for charity and running loads of marathons every day and all that sort of stuff. And then, unfortunately, he was diagnosed with cancer again. And I just kept saying to him, look, I've got to live with this elbow for the rest of my life. You're probably going to recover. And, you know, lo and behold, he has, and he's back, and he's going to break 3 for the marathon. So we're going to talk about him. But I was kind of put you in that. It's not your shin wasn't as bad as my elbow, I would say, because I've got 8 screws in my elbow. How many screws have you got in your shin?
0.
There you go. All right. Anyway, let's move on from there. So that happened then. So how did you get home then? What happened about getting home? Did you go home or did you stay and carry on fighting with like a broken tibia?
Man? Yeah. So no, I booked an early flight home. I had to change my flights to business class because I was in a cast up to my hip, so I couldn't bend my knee. So my first and only time flying business class was on the way home from Bangkok in a cast up to my hip. So yeah, got home, and I suppose I was in a cast for, I don't know, what is it, 3 months, something like that. I couldn't fight for over a year, and my coach was terrified of me fighting again, to be honest, in case it would happen again. But yeah, no, eventually got back to fighting. What age was I then? Yeah, I broke my shin at 21, got back fighting I think when I was 23, and you know, fought some good guys, you know, beat some good guys, and eventually fought for the Irish cage title at the time. Against another great fighter, Dominic Kelly, and unfortunately lost that fight. And
did you actually win any fights? Because all I'm hearing is I lost. Lost this. Did you win any?
Yeah.
What's your fight record?
17 fights. What was it? 12 wins, one draw. The rest were losses.
Okay, mine was 36 fights, 30 wins.
Delighted for you.
Yeah, there you go. Anytime, son. Anytime. So you're back. Then what happened then? What happened with your life? What about your love life? What was going on now at this time? You're a young man, virile, sculpted body, tough.
Yeah, so I mean, the breaking of the shin was kind of a fork in my life at the time, because I was going out with Claire at the time, and she was like, you know, nah, you're going out to Thailand for 3 months. I'm not waiting for you to come back. So we broke up.
Mm-hmm.
And as well, you know, my job, you know, as I say, working 52 weeks of the year, I couldn't get someone to cover me for 3 months. So left that job as well. I kind of risked it all basically to try and pursue a Thai boxing career.
Mm-hmm.
Or something along those lines. And yeah, I didn't know exactly what I was going to do with my life, but I was like, look, I'll go with this. And obviously it seemed to backfire at the time. And yeah, went to rehab, and got back fighting. And I did. No, I fought some good guys. Fought some really good guys in Ireland. You know, I won about four fights before fighting Domi, and you know, lost to Domi, and then I went up to Dublin then to do a master's degree, and that's kind of really, I suppose, where my sporting career took a real pause. Really, and it was for the master's degree, just to kind of, I suppose, focus on that, because I was like, I lost to Domi, and I was like, look, I don't think I'm talented enough for this, you know, to really pursue this as a career. So, you know, I better get some bit smart.
So what you're saying is you're a little bit, I mean, like I alluded to earlier on, and the regular listeners will start to get the strand and the themes and the beautiful woven tapestry that I'm creating now is, you know, earlier on we said that the people that go into kickboxing, the people who can't make it as boxers. So really, as a kickboxer, you're like an ultra runner. You can't make it as a marathoner or you know, yeah, middle distance runners. Is that so? You are kind of mediocre.
Yeah.
Would you say?
Yeah.
I love your humbleness. But so you did your master's degree, and then what happened?
Yeah, so I did that then, and I actually went after that. Then I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew in my master's degree, because I went to the Smurfit School, and I was in the room with some incredibly smart people, and I knew when I was up there, this isn't really the, I suppose, thing that I want to do in my life, I guess, you know. And wanted to do some soul searching, so went back out to Thailand again, where I went to Koh Samui, met Sean Clancy out there, who obviously knew beforehand, and had two fights out there, won the two fights, went to do some traveling afterwards, and got a job then eventually in the motor trade. And it was a buddy there then. We sat down for lunch one day, Conor O'Keefe, who also done Thai boxing at the time, and is a well-known ultra runner now in the Ireland scene. We sat down for lunch, and Conor was like, we should go back fighting, boy. And I just knew I didn't have the love for it anymore. I didn't feel, you know, at the age I was and the talent that I had, that I could go, you know, far. And Conor had some bad losses as well at the time, and I was like, look, I don't think this is for us. And we had just watched a podcast on ultra running. So Conor, being the impulsive guy that he is, said, Google up, there is a 100-mile race coming up. So I did that, and there was one in 7 weeks' time. And he was like, perfect, because we were used to 6 to 8 week fight training camp. So we were like, oh, 7 weeks, yeah, be grand. But at the time, I remember just saying to Conor, I fucking hate running, Conor. And he was like, he just said to me, he was like, don't even think about it, boy, just book it. And I was like, I don't want to do this. I didn't enjoy running as a Thai boxer. I wasn't the best runner there. Like, you know, Conor actually was a far better runner than me in the gym. Sean Clancy was probably mentally the strongest person there. He was a very good runner. So again, I didn't really see any talent there myself. I was like, oh. But then he goes, what else are you going to do? And again, I was normally focused on, say, I would have one or two fights a year, and I had nothing planned. So I was like, the time is going to pass anyway. So I said, look, fine, book it. So we booked it, and I remember that day, right, I got home and I ran, I don't know, I tracked it on some kind of an app thing. I ran 10K, and I was like, that was, you know, you need to run a lot more than that. So I went back out then after 10K, and I ran another 6, and I remember I came home and I was like, you need to do that 10 times, you're in trouble, because I was bollocksed. So took on from there, really. And I remember, you know, I was kind of telling Conor about my training, and he was like, you're going to run yourself into the ground, man. And I was like, no, it'd be grand, I'll just keep on running hard. And I didn't really understand injuries or about the body or this. I was just used to getting the old school type of training. Second week of training, got plantar fasciitis, could barely walk in work. I mean, I was limping around in work. The lads in work were laughing at me, being like, better luck next year, like, you know, as in, there's no way you're going to do this race. So I was doing a little bit of weights and things like that. And at the time, I should say, in terms of training cardio wise, all I was doing was I was doing a bit of weight training, and I would just do maybe if I felt like at a 1 kilometer warm up, just to get the blood flowing. But that was the only type of running I was doing at the time. And I'd never ran a marathon or a race or anything before. And yeah, got the injury. So hopped on a cycling bike for a few times, did a few spinning classes, that. Came right about 2 weeks to go, and me and Conor rocked up to Connemara with zero business being there, not a clue what we're doing. I didn't have a GPS watch, none of that. And took on, and word kind of spread out that we only had 7 weeks training, because Fergus, one of Conor's friends, had was asking people on the pre-race brief, you know, about their training, this, that. And he was like, these two lads have only trained 7 weeks, and we were being laughed out the door anyway, as you would expect. And I remember Conor going up to Ray, the race director, and, you know, asking, was it okay if we'd run together? And he asked Conor, you know, what's his marathon PB? And I think Conor said, you know, 3:45 or something like that. And then he asked me, and I just went, same. Because I didn't have a PB. I never ran a marathon. So I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. I hope he doesn't know that I don't know what I'm doing. But, so we started off together. And then about, 30 odd miles in, tore both my calves. It started pissing rain. I didn't even bring a rain jacket. I was so unorganized. And I sat into the car to take on some food. And when I got back out of the car, I couldn't fully extend my legs.
Yeah.
And I couldn't understand what was going on. So just kind of kept going on from there. About 40 odd miles, then Connor's knee blew up.
Yeah.
And Conor was like, we need to start walking, boy. But I couldn't walk at the time, because when you walk, you kind of fully extend your leg. And my calves were torn so badly, I couldn't straighten my legs. So we were arguing amongst each other about what we should do. So we kind of separated after about 40 miles. And we got to mile 55, which there's a checkpoint at mile 55. And my Claire and my mom went in to get quickly to something to eat. And my dad just came up and he goes, how are you doing? And I just went, my calves. And he kind of grabbed my calves to massage them. And I just burst into tears. I was like, and I shouted at him, stop. And one of the race stewards like heard me screaming and he ran over. And I was just like, I was just in tears. I was in so much pain from him doing that.
You seem to cry a lot.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. And I could see the steward just shaking his head at my dad, and you could just see the doubt into our faces. And I just said, look, burst my blisters, I have blisters everywhere. So we burst all my blisters, taped them all up, and just put the shoes back on, and just went back out into the road. And I don't know, a couple of miles later, I got a rain jacket off Claire, because I was like, I better actually put a feckin' rain jacket on now, because I was buckling the whole time. And 27 hours of suffering and torture, just got through it.
Yeah, and just interesting, to peel you back there a little bit, we'll just to let you know, we are getting into Mark's journey on from the 3:22 to the 2:29. But you mentioned Claire there, but you said that you and Claire had split up and you'd gone off to Thailand. So what happened there? So you came back and obviously you met him and rekindled the romance?
Yeah, so I came back, we were split up for about 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
Came back. Yeah, I just got in contact when soon before I started that new job with Conor, and just rekindled things again.
Yeah. Okay. And so you're now sort of you're going out with Clay. You've done your 100-mile race, and you decide that running is for you. You actually like it in a sort of a masochistic way.
Well, no, actually, after the race, I texted everyone saying I'd never do that again.
Okay.
I thought I'd be done.
So what happened then after you got the 100-miler, and then how did you get into, you know, pushing on from the running?
Yeah, so I couldn't even walk basically after that. I was actually on crutches for a few days, and I guess, I let the body heal. I did no running until I think it was the end of October. That was in August. End of October, I signed up for another 100-mile race, I think with 6 weeks to go.
Yeah.
So I went from 7 weeks training to this 6 weeks to this time. And I think it was the Wicklow Way 100-miler. I don't think they do it anymore. It was a different race organisation at the time. But I ran that in 26 hours. And I was like, oh, I'm improving now. And I think I'll try and do something else. So I signed up for a 200-mile race, which was the following year. And I remember what I used to do was I used to run to and from work. And Conor spotted me one day, and Conor was like, oh, what are you doing? And I said, oh, I'm training for a 200-miler. And he was like, oh, I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
So Conor signed up for that then as well. And I pulled out after 100 miles. I was in agony with my knee. Whereas in fairness to Conor completed the 200-mile race at the time. And what was that? That was 2019. Did the Kerry Way Ultra then later on that year as well. I think it came to top 10 in that. And 2020, then COVID came, ran 200 miles around my house in COVID, and then ran the Kerry Way in that year as well. But I DNF'd in Connemara that year, and I was really, really struggling with injuries. Really, I knew I was plateauing, knew I wasn't progressing, and that's where I met John Starrett.
Yeah, I remember you contacted me at the time, so it's interesting to you know, to learn all of that. And obviously all of this was on the profile questionnaire that we do, you know, with the coaching. And I knew that I think I mentioned this in the last episode, or maybe not, maybe it was when I was talking to somebody, but whenever somebody comes from a sporting background in some way, shape or form, if they were half decent at it, they can actually make pretty decent runners if you can control them and just make them understand that things take a little bit of time. So one of the things obviously you wanted to do was to run the 24-hour race. So I remember doing the coaching with you, and we just sort of got you into sort of progressive structured coaching, and you were just progressing week on week on week on week. Mm. And then you did a 12-hour race, which you won. And then just after that, the old ladyboy injury came back to your tailbone, and you were out for the better part of a year with that, was it? About a year? Oh, yeah. No. So sorry, have I jumped the gun there? Was it Belfast and COVID before that?
So what are we now? I contacted you in December 2020.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, COVID was still around. So Belfast is normally in June, but they postponed that because of COVID. But in fairness to Eileen, she did the 12-hour, the Killorgan 12-hour instead.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that instead of the 24-hour, so I won that. And then the 24-hour was postponed until October, so we were training from June to October. Everything was going smoothly, 100%. And it was actually the day before the race, I knew I was a bit fluey, and you told me get tested for COVID, and I was like, nah, there's no way I have COVID. And you were like, no, get tested.
Just let me intervene, you'll cut across you here. Yeah. Just so everybody knows, Mark is a conspiracy theorist, anti-vaxxer, anti-everything. He's just so you get, in case you hadn't picked that up, gone. So you didn't want to do the COVID test, gone.
Thanks for that intro, yeah. That's not why I didn't want to do the COVID test. I just
wanted to say that.
That's
though,
okay. No, I didn't think I genuinely didn't think I had COVID, but you were like, no, get tested. So got tested, and yeah, tested positive. And I remember saying to you, I'll test myself again in the morning and see if I'm negative. And you were like, you fucking idiot. Like, no, yeah. You're done. So so that was that. And then what happened after, I suppose, something kind of changed. There was a bit of a flip in my mentality for some reason. Like, I'd follow, everything went smoothly in the training. I'd follow everything as you said, right? I don't know why I got a little chip on my shoulder, I think, after that setback. And for me, what happened was I just started pushing that bit harder on easy runs, long ones, which for ultra running is exactly what you shouldn't be doing. And issues started happening then, I think the end of February, start of March, I started getting kind of pains around low back, kind of tailbone area, and kind of ignore it as best I could for a while. But eventually, you know, I started moving on to other areas and my knee and things like that. And it just kind of spiraled from there, really. I was kind of stopping, starting for a while. And I put too much pressure on myself because I was like, no, you know, you need to break the 24-hour record, even though I was in no shape to do it at that stage because of the stopping, starting. And I got to the start line. I really shouldn't have started the race, but I did, you know, again, it was poor communication between me and John because I kept telling John that I was fine, even though I knew deep down I wasn't. I just kept, like, even though I was, training fairly consistently, I was just watching my performance go down and down. I was kind of spiraling into a little bout of depression. You know, I would do a long run and just go home and go to bed for the day. It was quite tough. But again, this kind of comes into communication. I never communicated any of that to John as well. And, you know, unfortunately for Claire as well, she kind of had to put up a lot of my crap for that. And then, yeah, I did the race at about, I think it was about 4 or 5 hours in, I rang you and I was like, no, I don't think something's right here. And you thought I was being just a little bit of a bitch, really. So jog on, you'll be fine. And again, so yeah, so what did I do? I was just in horrible pain, really. I did 100 miles in 17 hours, I think, something like that. And I just called it there. I knew if I could just get to that, I could live with doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
But for me, really, it was one of the biggest mistakes. I think it was probably the biggest mistake of my running career was to push on for that race. I think that kind of really spiral on the issues that were already there and made them worse. And I feel if I didn't do that, you know, I probably wouldn't have dug myself in the hole that I was in for so long. But again, this comes back to, like, you know, like old school type training of just, you know, push on, go harder, go home stuff. It's these lifetime habits that we struggle to forget.
And as I mentioned earlier there, this is one of the things with people that come from a different sport and come into running, is trying to teach them that running is a lot different to the other sports. It's not about putting more in. Quite often it's doing a lot less, maximising the most that you can get out of the training before pressing on. You've got all of these tools in your toolbox, miles and sessions and things like that. Quite often you don't need to use them. The better hold them back and use them at a later date so that the runner's got space to grow into, which Mark is fully aware of now. So Anyway, that all happened. You had the injury, and just to cut a long story short, you spent, was it a better part of a year, seeing every therapist, physio, chiropractor on the planet, and then suddenly you discovered the man. Mm. Tell us about the man.
Shang-Ji is a coach in the States, yeah. And I suppose more of a sports performance coach, but also rehab. And yeah, I suppose the easiest way to explain it is it's kind of like plyometrics. Now, I had to sign an NDA as well, so there's very little I can kind of speak about there, but there is some stuff that he does put out that's for free, which a lot of people can benefit from. And a lot of guys I coach benefit a lot from the free stuff that he puts out there. But again, just have to trust the process. You know, I still do these exercises daily to this day. And
it's been good so far, hasn't it?
It's been good so far. You know, like I've done all this silly stuff. Like I've done, you know, the kind of hip mobility exercises, the kind of weird, weight kind of lengthening exercises, like a lot of the online stuff, ATG stuff, all that, tried it. You know, just most of it's nonsense, to be honest with you. It just looks good on Instagram.
You like Instagram, like me. But the main thing is the guy got you sorted out. You got back running sort of August, September time last year, built up gradually. But prior to that, though, you came in, you did my course out in Kenya, the coaching course. Mm. And off the back of that, you jacked in the car trade.
Yeah.
And started doing the coaching. You've set up a cattery, which is, for anybody who wants to know, is going really, really well, isn't it? It's booming. It's fantastic, really. In fact, we're going to be putting our cats in there when we go away. We trust him that much.
Claire's the face of it. Yeah, Claire's the face of it, yeah. If I was the face of it, it wouldn't be doing too well.
But you are the cat whisperer. I saw you talking to our cats when you came in. Yeah. So, okay, well, but even though they were ornaments, they weren't real cats. So anyway, and then and from there, so you did the course for me, and then come out of that, and then got the cattery going, set up your coaching business, and it's sort of like it's picking up all of the time. Been really successful. Some good runners now progressing all of the time the way they should be. But where this gets interesting now, I think, is sort of come January, you're out in Kenya on the trip that we run as a group there, which I spoke about last week. So we won't stay in there, but. One of the things that we did, Mark was saying to me that he wanted to break 3 hours for the marathon, and he's got a 3 hour 22 PB. I said, you won't be able to do it because you're an ultra runner. You know, you've got no talent and all that sort of stuff. I could just see him getting wound up on that. But when we're out there, he did some hill blasts, which I was a little bit concerned about because of his back. I didn't want him to get injured and things, or his tailbone rather. But they really took off, and he sent me a video of him doing them when he got home, and I thought, whoa, there's a bit of power and speed in there. So the old shadow boxing, kickboxing is there. Kicking in, and that was evidence then in what was happening in his training, because he was starting off with like a 20 minute tempo when we're out in Kenya, I don't know, Kenya rather, and he was doing like 7 minute miling or something like that. I thought, the lad's got no hope. But now, only a few months later, Mark's banging out 10 miles in 60 minutes in training as a, you know, really controlled. So that's where we've put this goal now for him to break 2:30 for the marathon in Valencia later on in the year. So going from like a 3:22 PB and just jogging in January to now, this is where he's at. So, excuse me. So what we're going to focus on with Mark and other people as we move forward through the course of the year from now to December is looking at the training that he'll be doing. So he's currently on the super base along with the hill blast, and that's working really well. I mean, how have you found things so far?
I mean, everything's going smooth. But again, I think, again, a lot of it's just kind of come down to the time that I'm in the sport, because, yeah, I mean, I get little niggles here and there. You know, I've had a small few issues with glutes. We did a little bit of dry needling. I tried to manage it on my own, but sometimes you have to just call and say, no, look, I need a little bit of help here. Same with, like, kind of lower limb stuff, a little bit of stuff with shins, but nothing major.
Yeah, good. So, I mean, are you confident that you can break 2:30?
Yeah, I mean, when we first spoke about this, I was like, oh, John, I don't know, I wasn't feeling too confident. I had small issues with my glutes, and again, I was struggling to manage it on my own, but we've cleared that now, and no, I'm definitely confident, yeah.
Okay, good. So that's what we'll be looking at with Mark and his journey, and we'll be talking specifically about how we're going to get him, and this is something that we'll discuss together rather than me dogmatically saying to Mark, this is what you're going to do. We'll discuss it, because Mark's obviously, like I said, an experienced coach, his same philosophy, has the same philosophy as me in terms of coaching and the same outlook. So, you know, it's not just going to be a one-sided thing. And we'll talk about that, and we'll have Mark back on to see how things are going as well. But from your own coaching now, Mark, so how's all of that going? And, you know, and Where do you see yourself? Because one of the things that I teach the people on the course is, you know, the basics across the board, so they can come out and they can coach beginners through elites. But I say it's important to learn the art of the marathon or the art of coaching as well. And do you find you're finding your own voice now rather than just mine?
Yeah, I know.
Excuse me. Carry on.
You okay? You dying there?
Yeah, I need a fag. Go on.
Yeah, I know, definitely. Definitely finding my own voice. Like, I mean, I think every athlete is different, aren't they? Like, I mean, you know, you can have systems in place, but it's all about tweaking things as the athlete progresses. You know, looking at things on a you know, weekly and a monthly basis, while also keeping the longer term picture in mind. You know, sometimes an athlete will have an idea of what they want in the short term, but I feel like sometimes you have to dig out what they want long term. So they might say to you, okay, I wanna race, I don't know, something like 3 marathons in 3 months, and you'd be like, okay, but I don't know. For example, they might want to break sub-3, and they might be at 3:30, and you might think they might feel that running 3 miles in 3 months is the best thing to do. That to go sub-3, whereas you know you kind of have to help them figure out what's the best way to do that, you know, and just help them along that journey, because that's it. They might say to you, they want one thing, but really, what's the long-term goal for you? I think is key.
And from a coaching point of view, what do you think is the most important thing? If you had to pick one thing that you would say, you know, give advice to somebody who wants to become a coach. It's great having all of the science, but for me, most of the people who study the science, and I studied the science as well myself years ago and stuff like that, don't necessarily make great coaches. What do you think makes a great coach? I mean, you coach Muay Thai as well, don't you?
I coach kids, yeah, once a week for Muay Thai. For me, it has to come down to communication with the athlete. That for me is where the art comes into it. You know, a lot of times, even like, I might have an idea what I want to do next week, but the athlete might necessarily tell you they're tired, and even the paces might look great, but you might again read between the lines on what they're saying. And you might say, you sound a little bit tired, I'm going to tweak things maybe slightly just for next week. Actually, I think one of the biggest problems we nearly have is the athlete is progressing too fast.
Yeah, and holding them back.
Sometimes it's just peeling them back a small bit. Communication is everything. I mean, that's where the art of it comes in. I mean, if you're not communicating with your coach, I mean, that for me, that's not coaching.
Yeah. I mean, there are some people who like to just get on and do their training as well. But what I say to the people that I coach is that the people that do the weekly feedback with me, message me, book calls with me, they're the people that improve the most and get injured the least. Because it's one thing looking at the data, you know, on Strava or Garmin or whatever, but it's another thing understanding what's underneath there as well. So somebody might do a session, it looks good, but you might not know if the hamstrings have tightened up or they've got a little bit of a niggle or there's something going on with their family or their personal life. So all of those things, I think, would you agree, sort of like marrying?
For sure. Look what I just said there earlier about me and the injury and kind of spiraling and spending so long on it, because I don't know why I just bottled it up. I didn't communicate anything to you.
And do you find that's an issue with people that you coach or in life, is, you know, about people bottling things up and not talking about them opening up? Because I know it's an area that you've got a bit of an interest in.
It can be for some people, but actually I think a lot of people will open up and they will tell you about, you know, their lives and what's going on. And I think, you know, for an athlete that you take on, like, you know, well, talent is one thing. You know, talent's a big part of it, don't get me wrong, but it's only one part. I mean, you also have their environment is huge.
Like
what's going on in their home life, how supportive are their parents, how supportive are their partner, what's going on in their work, what's going on in their college, that's huge, you know. And then you have mindset and discipline as well, you know, how resilient are they, like how strong are they mentally, you know, what's their discipline like. These are all elements of the athlete that you have to take into account. Like talent is a big part, but these parts are big as well.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think at the top end, the talent's a massive thing. You know, you've got to have talent if you're going to be at the top end. But I think, say, somebody's looking to break 3 hours, the things that you're talking about there, in my opinion, are more important, really. I mean, because for me, like, pretty much anybody with a reasonable sort of athletic-type background, they, you know, as long as they're not smoking 40 fags a day and on the Caprice every night, you know, they should be able to break 3 hours. It's I know people see that as a barrier and a challenge and things, but most people who apply themselves and can train 4 or 5 times a week can break 3 hours, depending on age and experience and what's going on. But they're the important things, as you alluded to there, you know, about life and college and work and family and things. So moving forward, how do you see things, apart from your running, the coaching, where do you see it going and developing, just to kind of wrap things all up?
Yeah, I mean, I've got Killian's running this weekend now. I mean, Killian just smashed 250, sorry, this weekend.
Yeah.
And I have two ladies as well, Shauna and Tina, running Boston. Like, Shauna's got big potential as well to do very, very well. But again, these are long, this is why we talk about the long-term picture with people as well. And talent is important, but, you know, it's the consistency over the long-term is where people can do really, really well. Yeah, so for me, yeah, it's just looking over the long term with people and just helping them along that journey.
Yeah. Do you think that's the most important thing from a coaching point of view? You've got to have a really genuine desire to want to help people. Because I know people look at coach. Okay, as we said at the beginning of the podcast, we let all bloopers and mistakes stay in for your amusement and my horror, and we just had one there. The podcast was set for 1 hour recording, which I don't even know about, but it's just cut off. So we could actually get Mark's wife, Claire, they're happily married now, to fix it all for us because she's got a master's degree in digital media. But we're not going to do that. And we've got the dog rolling around on the floor in the background as well. So if you hear any background noise, it's not Mark getting amorous and resorting back to his ladyboy days. But anyway, where we left off there, I was just asking Mark, what do you see for your coaching for the next year or so?
Yeah, so I mean, in the group, there's a good few people now at this stage looking to run sub 3 this year. So the main thing is just keeping them healthy and progressing along. And I'm sure there's a good few in that group will do it. Again, next year then, there's plenty in there that had the potential to go sub 3 and even sub 2:30 in the group as well. So definitely exciting times. And it's just about constantly communicating with the athlete, making sure they're happy with the training, keeping them fit, keeping them healthy. And yeah.
Good stuff. And sorry about the dogs in the background. They're getting a bit amorous as well. In fact, Mark, hold the show for a second. I'm just going to throw the dogs out. Out. Hold the show, man. Keep talking. Dogs out. Hey, Ben, out. Mark, hold the show together. You're letting it crumble. What you like? You can't cope with the pressure. Anyway,
crumbling,
Mark.
Crumbling.
So, crumbling Mark, like his shin bone, his tibia. It's shattered. Okay, so just to like wrap this all up now.
You've worn me out, John.
I've worn you out, yeah. I'm a stud muffin. So yeah, just to wrap this all up before it goes pee-tong, is where do you see you running over the next year as well? You know, for me as a coach, like, you know, obviously we discussed quite a bit about the 2:30 thing, but after this, where do you see yourself going?
Yeah, I mean, obviously this year we'll be focused on going sub 2:30. Staying injury free is probably the number one goal. Going sub 2:30, I think, is second after that. So making sure they're staying fit and healthy. Afterwards, I mean, I don't say I'm done with ultra running. I think the ultra running standard in Ireland is growing all the time.
You reckon?
Go on. It was two years when I was looking to break the record, but this year I feel it'll be broken again. Adrian McNamara is probably the best ultra runner on the scene at the moment. I mean, the training he's doing is phenomenal.
He's talented, isn't he? He's gonna do well.
So he's raising the standard all the time, and I know if he can put his training together on the day, he'll smash those times and just keep raising the bar for the rest of us. And gives me something to aim for in the future.
And you're good mates with Adrian as well, aren't you?
He's an absolute gent, probably one of the nicest guys in the scenes. He was one of the few people as well who would constantly check in on me as well while I was injured, make sure I was okay, doing okay, and an all-round nice guy.
Yeah, and just talking about all-round nice guys to wrap this up, when I was out in Mauritius, Mark would phone me every day to make sure I was okay. He's the only person who did. Nobody else bothered about me apart from Mark. That's why he's my favourite. Sean Stokes was my favourite last week. Mark's my favourite this week. So, yeah, just with a little bit of a Thai reference there, we have a happy ending. Because Mark and Claire got married. They've got a little baby now, Penny. Beautiful little baby. 7 months old?
7 months now, yeah.
Yeah, so congratulations there. And, you know, life seems to be in a nice space for you. You're able to work from home, coaching. You've got the cattery. Claire helps you and you can help out and be around with Penny. So it's all looking good for you for the future. And what we'll do is we'll bring Mark back on because he'll do anything for a free lunch. he'll be up here for some grub. And then we'll just talk about Mark, the specifics of Mark's training in the next time he comes up, because we'll be going into, you know, how he's going to break the 2:30 from a training perspective, that is. And we'll just check in and see how his coaching is going. But it's good to get that background on here. Really interesting story and great to have Mark on here. And just to close it all off, then we have to do the competition. what was the name of my guest today? Now, that's a tough one. Make sure you get it right. You can fire it across to me on my phone number. Here it goes. For anybody outside of Ireland, 00353-049-5669. Or you can get me through my website, stazzastable.com, or on Instagram, stazza_stable. And just on that, Mark, so how can people get in contact with you about coaching?
Yeah, so you can email markomanirunning@gmail.com or find me on Instagram, mark_omani_running on Instagram.
Brilliant stuff. And I hope you enjoy the little blooper there that we had with the 60 minutes. We were both panicking, thinking, you know, how do we fix that? And I thought, now we've got to leave it in because we said we'd leave it in. So we have. We tell the truth here. At that point as well, Mark was able to get some water. I was going to be able to put on a splash of Santos de Cartier for Mark just to finish it all off with. Anyway, thanks for listening and speak to you next week.
Put your pants back on.
They are. Give us a chance.